The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Unfiltered opinions.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
As you secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Mayaha.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to another episode of Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters, as you know, live streamed for your viewing pleasure every Monday, with the rest of our show set to come out later in the week. I'm back from Cape Town, Si's going to Cape Town, but we've still somehow found a way to put the show together for you. Shout out to our TikTok community. Good morning to you guys as well. We absolutely love having you guys on board. We're going to be taking a look at last week's race decision in Market Matters. We're going to be reflecting on what that decision means for South Africa and where we go from here. There's been talk about revising our inflation targeting, and we're going to look at all of those permutations if we can. We're also going to reflect on the month of May from a trading perspective. It seems as though that was somewhat of a positive month alongside April. It's been the strangest second quarter of the year, probably in history, with the President of the United States being who he is. But we're going to look at that. We're going to see what June holds for us. Hopefully we can see where we go from here. And then we're going to take a look at something quite interesting in our deep dive. In our deep dive, we're diving into the world of funeral policies, funeral service providers. So stick around for that. Some very interesting tidbits around that space. Yes, there is a financial link to that, and that's kind of why we have them on the show. It isn't just about the business of funeral policies, but around the things that you need to know. And then we're going to wrap up things with Investor Insights, taking a look at a very interesting delisting announcement from a South African company called AO Technologies. I want to take a look at that because the PIC was heavily invested in that business, and now we're talking something else. But that's the rest of the show for now. We're going to get into Market Matters. Before we get into Market Matters, Si, I was at the Finance Magnates Summit, obviously, right? So that was last week. We missed you there. And I say we because I wasn't the only one there. We have a super fan. Yeah, super fan. Super fan, super fan. And sorry, for folks that are out there listening via audio, I do this, and this might just actually become a new segment that we do on the show. I love to see Simon's reactions to things because they're so amazing. So this is Si's reaction to the superfan that I found in Cape Town. For context, sure. This young gentleman is studying computer sciences at UCT and took time out of his day to come to Finance Magnus to come see what was happening at Finance Magnus, but specifically said, look, he was looking forward to seeing us and hoping to see us there. And I never knew we had super fans. I certainly didn't think we had super fans. But he was, when he told me he misses lectures to watch the show, a part of me was like, you probably shouldn't be doing that.
You know what? I miss lectures for way worse reasons.
This is true. That's like, why,
there was good surf, I would miss a lecture. So at least, I mean, just hey.
Yeah.
But it did seem like the number of messages I got from people, are you in Cape Town?
Yes.
No, I am not in Cape Town. I had a birthday party and stuff, and so I could not get there.
But you will be there. I know you have got some work that you'll be doing there this week, so you'll be heading out there this afternoon. Mm. But yeah, we've got super fans out there, and guys are absolutely loving the content that we produce. We'll continue to do our very best to not let you guys down and to keep giving you the insights that we promised to. Speaking of those insights, last week's MPC decision,
Hey, it was a majority decision.
And we got it right, because we called on Monday, in Monday's episode last week, we called 25 bips.
Yeah, I know, grudgingly, we wanted 50, but we know our MPC. We did get, I mean, to be clear, there's been some 3-2s on the last couple of cuts, and the 2s are not like 0.5%, they're like no cuts. So we did get a majority into it. To be clear, and inflation is 2.8. Mm. Now there's all the, I must say, listening to the Q&A, and it was difficult, because I was recording, I was standing in for Jeremy's. So I heard some of the, but his whole story around the inflation targeting and stuff was, I had forgotten the original plan back in February 2000 mm-hmm. was a 3-6, then a 3-5, and then a 2-4. In other words, to sort of scale it down, but then things went wobbly and Trevor Manuel blinked.
Wow. So this was already something we're supposed to do. Okay. So if we go 2-4, that means midpoint is 3%. Right now we're at 2.8. We could just go 3-6 down to 2-4 immediately and go straight to that 3%, which is what Deputy Minister David Masondo wants us to do as well. He's touched on that.
I think it's what's going to happen. Whether we go 2-4 or 3, I kind of like the 2-4, but 3 is to me just clearer and
it's a number.
It's a number rather than a range. And anyway, our governor's going to say 3.
That's it. Yeah. I'm going to anchor at the midpoint of the range anyway.
But we've had the same target for 25 years. And to be clear, our economy has evolved and changed and boomed and bumbled for those times. It's an exciting time to be alive. And I know that's a very nerdy thing to say, but I'm excited for changes to our target. And we could drop to 2-4 or 3. And effectively, he also then said that he thinks that his resting rate, and of course there's fancy economic word for it, I can't remember. The resting rate for repo is then 6, which then puts prime at 9.5. Mm-hmm. And then our next discussion is we phone all the banks and we say to them, yo guys, the 3.5% markup on prime seems A, like a bit of collusion because you're all at the same.
Yes.
And B, a little bit extreme, because to be clear, banks were doing this in the 90s when prime was at points 26%. Yeah, I know.
So you're saying banks have been making money.
They make plenty of money. And they must drop that 3.5 to, so we could have a repo at 6, which puts prime at 9.5, but let's take some margin off the banks, because banks got plenty margins, and move that to 2.5. So then prime's 8.5. Yo.
That
is... Of course, we're a long way from there, because we're currently at 10.75.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey.
And at 25 bips per cut, it's going to take us a while to get down to that
we're
level.
We're going to be on to our third governor. When does our governor's term?
I think he's in his second term at the moment. The second term, I'm not sure when it's set to end. We'll check on that. But from an inflation point of view, I think what we don't realize is, and for the longest time, I also didn't kind of have this view, and I'm starting to adjust my view. I remember when there was a time where I said, look, let's...
I know, he's in his third term. From November, it runs to November 29. So by the time he quits, steps down,
yeah,
a 0.25%.
We might just be there.
Yeah.
So my thing around the inflation thing was, at some point I said, perhaps we should let inflation go a little bit in order for us to stimulate the economy, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I've had conversations with the likes of David Shapiro, who've raised valid points to say you can't have higher costs of business, higher costs of financing and things from an interest rate point of view, and that it doesn't make it conducive for business. And that's also effectively what our central bank governor has been saying by trying to anchor inflation lower, right? So yes, there's a bit of pain in how it is done and the mechanisms to anchor inflation lower, as we have been witnessing firsthand. Mm-hmm. But in the long term, it does prove to be beneficial. My question then becomes is, okay, inflation comes down to 3%. Repo goes to 6, as you said. Prime goes to 8.5, 9.5, whatever it is, below 10. Right? It's easier to finance things. It's easier to grow things. It's easier to do business. Banks still need to adjust their lending criteria to accommodate for business to be able to get financing.
100%. And they do better, because if we're all paying less on our debt,
they're taking less risk.
And we're not putting money under the bed. We're spending that money we save. So they make it up in other
ways. Okay. So that is generally beneficial from that perspective. But then how do you use that to drive growth? How do you then start to say, okay, it is cheaper to run a business here, to grow a business here, come do business here, but we still need to be driving growth. We had those conditions in probably the early 2000s where things were moderating, but we also had it recently in the pandemic where, because of the lack of movements and all of that in the economy, everything basically came down to a very low cost base to do things, but we still haven't really seen, and I didn't see it in the budget speech, And I'm still not seeing it from National Treasury and the government on how to stimulate growth. We still have an unemployment crisis.
So we actually had surprisingly high prime rates. Because you remember, so prime got down to around 13 in September 01.
Okay, before that, so maybe the 98-ish
era? So 98, it was at 26. It says 25 and a half, but I remember taking a bond at 26. And then we had the crisis. So every time it's sort of gone up and down and up and down, but the trend has been to lower highs and lower lows until the current bunch of ministers and their views. But it has been certainly trending down. So to your point, certainly lower inflation helps, lower inflation expectations helps. It helps cost of debt. It helps your economy. It removes the risk of a crazy inflation rates. All of those sort of things are really, really grand. What it doesn't do, and that all helps grow an economy. But there's more than just rates that grow an economy. Mm. There's also reliability of electricity. There's also ease of moving funds in and out. There's all of those sort of things. There's, you know, if I'm to build a widget factory, and I'm looking around planet Earth, why South Africa?
Mm.
You know, why not one of the other many, many
What's
markets,
the business
Asia,
case?
LATAM, all of those sort of things. So it's more than just that.
Mm.
And small things. I mean, I think the fact that our government of national unity is almost a year old is helping, because we saw something fundamental, which was the ruling party for 30 years lose and just say like, oh, chill, okay, let's talk. Instead of like, oh, not sure, let's shoot, which has been a trend amongst many countries in the world over the years.
Mm.
So there's lots to it. Unfortunately, a lot of it is our government and our government policies and...
See, speaking of government policies, I want to take a look at what we can look forward to in this month. Certainly no interest rate adjustments there. We know that this week is non-farms numbers from a data perspective into the US. But generally, we're halfway through the year. And I say halfway because we're in the last month of Q2, technically speaking.
No one works December. So.
Right, no one works December. So technically, we're about halfway through the year. And the market has had, I don't even want to say the most interesting time, because it's just been so much that's gone on. And what's the count sign? How many days left? 1,300 and how many?
I don't do it in my head, Jen. I've got to do it.
I dread it every time you bring it up. But the amount of days left of the Trump presidency is what we will do. Perhaps we should have a
1,328.
Perhaps we should have a clock on the show that counts us down. Because at some point, I fear we might need it.
I don't know. We've been stuck above 1,300, well, for actually 72 days is the honest truth. It feels like forever. We should have a party when we break 1,000. But
okay.
even that's like next year sometime. I mean, don't start buying, party balloons just yet. They're going to go flat.
Oh, we've got so much to get into. We've got so much that's happening in life.
But it also starts to happen. Although, so 9 July is the 90 days. Although it's awkward because...
We haven't even hit 90 days.
Since the step climb down. So it's awkward because the...
The 90 days of the tariffs. Yes.
So he keeps on talking about... So he gave China another 90 days. Then he gave Europe another 90 days. Is it the same 90 days or is it a different...
I asked the same question. Apparently, everybody gets their own 90 days.
So apparently... And Japan is just taking a hard line. I will find you the quote from the Japanese relevant minister, whose name I will not try and pronounce. Come on, where are you? The PM, we have no intention to compromise on US tariff. In other words, bring it on, buddy.
Well, to be fair, they are the one country that's already survived an atomic bomb from the US.
Two.
They're pretty much prepared for anything the US has to throw at them.
They're a small island. They've got more money under the bed than our president. And they're old. They're like, yeah.
They're like, no, we've seen how this plays out. We've survived this before.
And what does America have that Japan wants?
Nothing.
Well, actually, I was going to say adult diapers, but they get that from Germany.
Okay, aging population and all.
Japan sells more adult diapers than kids' diapers, which is not a surprise.
Yeah, well, their companies are 100 years old each.
Germany sells more adult diapers than kids' diapers. That is a surprise.
What? There's a conversation in there that's a sensitive one that we will not get into about the things the Germans used
Maybe
to do.
Maybe edit that out.
We'll edit that out. Side note, while we are on things that are detracting you from other topics, we continue to try. Sci this week is a gentleman by the name of John, with an H, not without the H.
Yeah, that's how you spell
it. No, it's a J-O-N without an H.
Yeah, but when you do that, you just confuse.
So that's what we've been trying to do, right? So I've been, while we're getting suggestions from our community, I thought, let's go specifically for names that might have more than one spelling. And I just pulled a list.
Keep it difficult.
Keep it difficult, but not say how things are spelled. So give you a name like Deborah. Our ghost mic is on Deborah, but Deborah could be D-E-B-R-A, or as you would say it, Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, which is Deborah, right? Both of them spell Deborah, just differently, right? I went in and I thought I could be Layla, which could be L-A-Y-L-A or L-E-I-L-A, depending on which part of the world you're in. The CEO of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, shout out to Dr. Layla Faree, is L-A-Y-L-A, right? I came out as Lelo. Not Layla, but Lelo.
Yeah.
We'll keep trying. We'll keep going. We don't know where this is going to end. We'll see where it goes. But what we do have to wrap up is our market matters. We do have to get onto our other content pieces and our other segments. And before we go, I want to take a look at, as we said, the markets and the performance of the markets. The JSE opening today, markets moving in somewhat of a positive direction. They've been positive since the Trump thing started, right? So since the Trump suspension of the unsuspension of the, we don't know what to call it.
Yeah, yeah.
Since that, markets have been moving on the up very calmly, very steadily. And I suppose markets don't want the volatility that comes with what happens later. You know, I'm looking at the markets now. I'm looking at the JSE opening up marginally in the green, but a lot better than where we closed out last week towards the 86,000 points level. We're now almost back at all-time highs at 87,000 points on the top 40. We will, by all accounts, break all-time highs this week, I should think. But that is the pattern and the nature of what we're going through at the moment. If I look at it from a performance perspective on a monthly basis, it's been positive months since the start of the year. So January was positive. Mm-hmm. Every month was positive, including the month where Donald Trump announced to the world that the world was being liberated, or that America was being liberated. Yeah.
I mean, our markets are doing great. Skolko does this thing. We're up 3.1% in the month. Our 12-month return is 27.3% for equities. I mean, these are big numbers.
That's huge numbers. Yeah. You definitely want to be in the South African market, clearly, or if you haven't been.
And it's not just us. So US markets are flat, but if you pull up other sort of EMs, and I mean, not even EMs and the like. So what have we got here? So we could bring in, India's doing lacquer, Mexico's doing lacquer. I mean, they're all up around, and this is just year to date. You know, we're up 24.5%. We're the lagger. Okay, who was EPI? EPI was India. Okay, so India's at 2%. Mexico's 28%. I mean, it has just been a fairly wild market. Germany, the DAX is up 32% almost. Aside from the US, and the US market's S&P up 0.5%, NASDAQ up 1.5%. That's year to date. Japan up 10%. There has just been really, really strong markets outside of the US. France up 18%, Australia, okay, Australia up 8%. But if we broadly just bring in emerging markets as a group, EMs are up 8.8% relative to the US, 1.5%.
Do we think that this has, I mean, a part of it is something you and I have spoken about the fact that US markets ran hot when other markets didn't, right? And they ran overly hot, and perhaps this is that cooling that naturally happens in a market, the natural kind of rebalance of things. But also, your incumbent isn't exactly being pro-market at the moment, I should think, which is interesting because we have a US company that we're going to be taking a look at in Investor Insights, but that one is a very special company.
Yeah.
That one is, so it is immune to these things.
That Trump has spooked the world. But to your point, US markets peaked in around October and they were expensive. And if you look at them on historical, they're like in the top 5% of expensive. This isn't like, oh, weirdly, they are very expensive.
Exactly.
Now, the Mag 7 or 6 or however many is left in there, they're mostly doing okay. I mean, so when I say, okay, so Alphabet, Amazon, they're doing like Nvidia, doing perfectly fine. Apple, and then Tesla. But
Meta.
They all came in quite expensive. Mm-hmm. There has been a sort of some re-rating happening in that space. And then money wants a home. And if we look at a 10-year US, which is now 4.443, that money which is left there, where's it been going? Well, it hasn't going into equity. The Russell 2000 is down 7.4% year to date. Mm-hmm. It's been going into other markets and gold.
And gold. Because everything's been going into gold of late. Let's look at gold before we go. Let's look at quickly where the gold price is. I think we are around the $3,300 mark. just going to see. I think it was 3,200 last I checked.
3,354 gold is running.
3,354. We're back above there. Okay, cool. So we closed out the week last week towards the 3,300, around 3,290-ish we were sitting in that range. So we're up at 3,350 again. Yep, gold is running. Gold is moving.
Week before last was the highest ever weekly close for gold. Mm-hmm. And I mean, gold, so it's been consolidating at around about 3,220 to 3,330. About $100. I got to say, I keep on expecting it to come back to around 3,000, and gold is like, nah.
No, that's quite interesting. Someone was asking me over the weekend in Cape Town, what is the worst thing that could happen to gold at the moment? And the only thing that came up in my mind was a rational Trump. And then we all laughed together. Because a rational...
So that's actually fair, because I had this conversation a while ago, and someone said, well, you know, Trump is however many years old, and notwithstanding he claims he has the physique of an NBA quarterback, he doesn't. He might be 6'3", probably not. He might be the weight he says, no. Anyway, and they were like, oh, but if Trump passes, we solved. I'm like, J.D. Vance? Mm.
So a rational Trump is the worst thing to happen to the gold price, because that would mean risk sentiment would come back into markets.
So in the short term, yes. In the longer term, what's playing out is central banks who abandoned gold for most of the 90s and the aughts, they're moving back in. And they're moving back in for a couple of reasons. The dollar's fine. They're worried about U.S. treasuries and how that plays out with the debt that they're sitting on. And what happened in the when Russia invaded Ukraine, when suddenly they realized that, like, you know, what's that saying? If it's not your wallet, it's not your crypto. And like, if it's not in your safe, it's not your money. So gold, they can physically put under the Kremlin or under the Red Square or under wherever, they can physically have it. And I think, you know, if you are a slightly antagonistic nation, you're certainly thinking that. But even if you're not an antagonistic nation, you're just like, hang on, it turns out that we could get cut off from everything. So even if you're France, you might be, although I don't know if the European countries still have gold things. Did they have to give it to the ECB?
I'm not sure. I think they did. We at least know the UK hasn't. We know that they will never do that.
Yes.
I'm going to posture a different theory as we part here. I'm going to take a page out of a local playbook. What happens to a company when its debtors decide we don't have the money to pay? QSA Taxi. That's Market Matters. We're going to leave it on that note. We will get into our deep dive. We'll put out the rest of the show later in the week. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Thanks for jumping onto the live. Lutlokonolo, thanks so much for doing that. We're glad you didn't miss lectures to join us. He was so interestingly enough, when I was showing you the video, he jumped onto our live chat to say good morning as well at the same time. So that was Market Matters, and that's where we're going to leave it. In our deep dive this week, we are diving into the world of funeral service providers, FSPs. Yes, funeral service providers, abbreviated to FSPs, but they also should be FSPs themselves. It's a little known fact that funeral service providers are registered and regulated financial services providers, and that comes with a set of implications. That's what we're going to take a look at. We're going to take a look at what that means for you and I as those that use those services, and how we can best understand where all of it comes together. Sai, the funeral world, not often something we don't really enjoy talking about. I mean, no one enjoys talking about death, but the reality of it is, with South Africa having one of the highest murder rates in the world, it's not something to be proud of by any
also
stretch
just
of the imagination.
Generally
and just life expectancy.
Yeah, and that's like HIV, AIDS,
human nature or human things happening, right? Surely for me, and I've always looked at this and thought, the funeral industry is a booming business.
Yeah.
Constantly booming. Constant supply of clients, constant supply of business. But many people don't realize this. It's actually a regulated space. It should be a regulated space, and you should be dealing with regulated parties in that space.
Yeah, and I hadn't occurred to me, but when you sent this yesterday, I'm like, so if we're just going to bury you and I'm going with my credit card and saying, I've got Jimmy, please can we bury him, you know, and I'm going to swap, that's a different story.
Yeah.
But for most people, there's policies and things involved, which means that you now need regulated and oversight and compliance and KYC and all of this sort of stuff. Hence, and so I just went to the FSP and typed in under name funeral.
Yes.
And there are lots, although I got to say, most of them are license withdrawn, rejected, lapsed. There are some authorized, but there are a lot of them. And I hadn't realized this, that you need to, because that's a lot of effort, but I mean,
yeah, so I think the part of it that becomes regulated and the part that we need to understand from a regulatory standpoint is, number one, the funeral policy itself is a financial product. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the FSCA is very clear around how financial products are regulated, no matter what the financial product is, whether it's a crypto platform, whether it's a CFD, whether it is a funeral policy. Yeah. That policy itself is a financial product. The second element of it that would then push it to be a regulated thing is you are collecting premiums for that product. Mm-hmm. So every time you pay a monthly fee, a monthly installment or whatever for your funeral plan or funeral policy, that is a financial product. This is why when a Sanlam or a clientele or whoever sells you, who tries to sell you these products, picks up the phone and says, hey, please note that we are an authorized FSP or we have agents that act under supervision and those sorts of terms and disclaimers, they have to notify you of that because it's a financial product. Yeah. And I think when you get a funeral policy, that should be your first thing. That should be the very first thing that you look at, is the person that's giving me the financial product itself, are they regulated to do so? Mm. Because in the funeral world, much like the insurance world, there is a service provider that sells you the actual policy. But then there is a separate financial company, a separate FSP, that is the underwriter that takes on the risk of that financial product. So it's not always the case that if Jimmy and Simon's funeral services sells you a funeral policy, that we are the ones underwriting that. We could have someone like a Guardrisk or a Santam or one of the big companies underwriting our policies. And in that case, you have to do extra due diligence to two FSPs. But the person selling you the product, that financial entity or that funeral service provider, has to be regulated.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the important point. And you know, I think a lot of us think of sort of funeral policies. You know, my housekeeper has a couple of them. Mm. But these are informal, sort of, you know, they're stockfills.
Stockfill type of setups, yes. Which stockfills have their own kind of governance structures to them.
And hers works actually very well, and you know, but it if you're doing it, you know, if you go into the AvBobs and the like of the world and the old mutuals, etc., to get them, they are, but it does mean that there are some folks out there who might not quite be legit.
That's it, right? And those are the folks that you need to be wary of. Because so part of this conversation came up because there was one of the funeral service providers that claims to be one of the best in the country and possibly one of the best on the continent and all sorts of things. And we've seen time and time again that people have strange complaints from a funeral perspective. Like, oh, I took out this policy and I was supposed to get these benefits and I didn't get those benefits. Mm-hmm. But now I've got no recourse. And I want to look at that from a protection point of view. If you're dealing with a regulated entity, you can then, under FASE law, which is the law that would then govern them, not Financial Markets Act, but the insurance laws would govern the funeral services, you can then file a claim and a complaint against the ombud and say, I was unfairly treated by this funeral service provider or by this service provider because this is what was said to me. This is the agreement I was made to sign. Mm-hmm. And this is what I got in the end, which again means that as Jimmy and Simon Limited, we then have to make sure that our documentation is up to scratch, that we provide the
Jimsum.
Jimsum. That's what we're going to call it, Jimsum. So as Jimsum, we need to provide our clients with regulated things that are above board because we're an accountable institution. Correct. And a lot of people, I mean, first of all, reading those policies can seem like a dreadful exercise in itself. And the last thing you want to do when you're having to deal with a claim or you're needing them to pay out or whatever is to go back and say, oh, no, I didn't see the fine print or whatever, or now I can't put a loved one to rest because we didn't have this cover or that cover. And again, that's where, I suppose this is where dealing with a regulated party gives you a little more security and a little more certainty.
Absolutely. And that's what you want. You know, when everything goes well, it doesn't matter who your counterparty is because everything went well and everyone's happy. Mm. It's when things don't go well. And the truth is that it's more likely to not go well with an unregulated because they just don't have the things in place. It's just not there. You know, Jimsum's just like two orcs who are like, yeah, we'll take your money, we'll invest it, we're good. Something goes wrong, it's like, oops, orcs. And there's no recall. And that really is it. Now, sure, it adds some costs to the process, but those costs are there designed to protect you.
So Have you ever been to a, and I, for lack of a better phrasing, I want to say a black funeral, but I, not specifically just a black funeral. I mean, a cultural funeral where there are certain things that are observed and there's certain traditions that are followed. There's certain steps that have to be put in place and all of that. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most important element at one of those events?
What do I think is the most important?
I'll tell you what it is, but I want to get your thoughts around it.
I don't know. I mean, I've been to loads, mostly in the 80s. And when I say loads, probably hundreds. Violence in the 80s. Mm. There was a civil war. I mean, to me, it was the closure.
Mm. Today, it's the food. It's the food, Sai. It's the food. Because a lot of what happens in kind of these cultural setups, there's animals that must be slaughtered as part of a sacrifice. There's people that must be fed that are coming to mourn with you. There's a catering company that is called in to make sure that all the guests have stuff. And so the catering part of it is a huge part of the business. Yeah. And a lot of what people look at. So when you kind of take out a policy and those sorts of things, people go in and say, perhaps we need coverage for the burial plot. We need coverage for the casket. We need coverage for the food. We need coverage for the tent setup and all those things on the day and the vehicles. The vehicles is another thing. We want this quality or this category of vehicle that goes into moving the family or the loved ones and all of that. So that's a lot of what happens in how those packages are put together. And so funeral service providers will say, okay, cool, here's a base package that covers burial plot, casket, basic services. Now you want catering covered, this is how much we add on to your premium. Now you want this covered, this is how much we add on, those sorts of things. So there's a lot of add-ons in this space. And I often wonder that if we're looking at that kind of thing. So yes, obviously you can outsource those services and all those things. From policyholder perspective, right? You clearly need to know what your premium is covering to know what you get out of it at the end. Because when you want to then lodge a complaint and say they promised to provide after tears alcohol and suddenly there's no after tears alcohol and people are like, but what do... Sorry, but also, you are aware of after tears
alcohol. The after tears alcohol, they might bring, you know, two bottles of Johnny Black and say we provided it.
Technically, we did.
Yeah.
The fact that you drank it all is not 60 shots.
And that's basically it. You and I sorted. What about everybody else?
What about everyone else? Exactly. So this space is so underrepresented, underspoken about from a financial standpoint. We often just go in and say, yeah, no, I put down 500 Rand a month. I expect 50,000 Rand when I need it. And then the funeral company says, okay, cool. Here's the 50,000 Rand that we promised you. But what we don't discuss is if I'm contributing for X amount of time, X amount of months or whatever, the funeral service provider has the right and the discretion to go and put that money in from a risk perspective to pay out, right? So they actually take the money, go out and buy other financial products, buy insurance products, buy financial services products, so that that money grows, isn't affected by inflation, and allows them to be able to pay out what they promise you, right? Now, it doesn't really clearly define, the legislation I don't think clearly defines where funeral service providers can invest the money. But this is where you start to see companies and these private funeral services platforms say, oh, but we put the money into this thing and now the money's gone and now we can't cover your funeral. And that then brings back to, should you then be putting those sorts of things together? And if you do, should you be doing it in a Stockwell structure or should you be doing it in an FSP structure, and how you best protect the little that you have to send off a loved one?
Yeah. So, I mean, the short answer is that I don't know that your Stockwell structure, I mean, I've just called up just, this is Claude saying, what does a funeral cost? And Claude's saying 15 to 50,000, although looking at some of the numbers,
that could just be the casket.
No, so basic coffins are 1 to 3, but fancy
one
ones...
1 to 3,000 Rand?
Yeah, for a basic one, but a fancy one's 50K or more.
Yeah, so funeral, the entire funeral can't cost 50K.
Yeah, you know, a burial plot is 2 to 10, but can be 50,000.
Have you seen,
the hearse is 5, flowers can be 5 or more, catering can be 2, but could be 20. I mean, this could easily run 100,000 plus.
250K.
Yeah.
Easy.
In which case so at the burial society that my housekeeper's on, and I don't know the exact mechanics of it, but every so often she has to pay 100 Rand to someone who within, so it's not just the member of the society, it's family as well. So children, grandchildren, partners.
Yes.
Every time someone passes, there's 100 Rand paid across to them.
Okay.
So, but this is a group saying about 30 people. So, I mean, sure, you got yourself 3 grand, but it's just 3 grand. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like, there's your after tears alcohol. Maybe. Depends on the size. But it's the level of cost, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
It is. It is a costly exercise to have a funeral, especially if you have more than one. Mm. And I think from a financial services point of view and from understanding the regulated side of it, it becomes important to then look at all of this that's happening and say, are we adequately covered?
Mm-hmm.
And is that coverage clearly defined? Because when it's not clearly defined is where the loopholes start to come in. Oh, yeah. But you didn't pay. So you took a basic package that doesn't give you access to this level of casket. It only covers you up to a 10,000 rand casket, not a 50,000 rand one. Or the flowers are only capped at 3,000 or whatever. And funny enough, that's not just limited to the funeral services space, right? That's the insurance space in general as well. The coverage that you have and the premium that you pay for, that's all stuff that is supposed to be clearly defined prior to you entering the agreement, so that it doesn't change at a later date.
And so that you don't get a surprise.
Yes.
Because they are also, I don't know. I can't remember what my parents' funerals cost, but at my mother's funeral, there was one bunch of flowers. I was a poor kid. Like, sorry, Mark. Weddings and funerals have become big business. And it is, to your point, is know what you're, now you can't buy wedding insurance.
Although, gypsum loading, guys, we got you covered.
Yeah, we're going to get so ripped on that. Hey? Like, take the policy today, propose tomorrow. It's like, whoops.
But that's why they've got those mandatory waiting periods, cooling off periods. Medical aid does it. You have a 30-day waiting period before they cover certain events.
You need a multi-year waiting period. But it's with any financial product you take, make sure you know what you're getting.
Otherwise, you find yourself in a situation where you get stuff you didn't pay for, or you don't get the stuff that you actually did pay for, that you thought you were paying for.
Yes.
I think the other important point around making sure you know what you're paying for is reduce everything to writing. Mm-hmm. This is, at the end of the day, it's a policy. Mm-hmm. It is a legal agreement. Mm-hmm. It is a binding agreement between you and a service provider. Put it all in writing. There should never be a point where someone says, oh, we can add that later, and then they don't add it later. If they add it later, fine. But then that's what's called an annexure to an agreement, and it's a supporting document that says, in addition to what we previously signed on this and this a day, these are the things that have changed. The same way when your adjustments or your agreements change from a service provider point of view, they notify you. Interest rate decisions happened last week. The banks have already started notifying people, hey, that mortgage that you have with us is now going to be 25 basis points cheaper than what it was this time last month, right? So there is that obligation to communicate changes in agreements to people. And that only happens if you've got your agreement reduced to writing.
Yeah, that's it. And it's the structure and the certainty. And you know what? Sometimes it doesn't go according to plan for a bunch of reasons.
Hmm?
At least there is then some recourse.
Some recourse, right? Yeah. Otherwise, you have no recourse. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where people start to then worry. That's where people start to have the concern, and people start to sit there and say, but we thought we had recourse. We thought we had support. We thought we were covered for this and this and this. And now we don't know where to go, or we don't know what to do. I mean, the last thing you want is to be paying for 5, 10, 15 years into a premium, and then at the end of it, find out it was not worth it, or you get nothing back.
Or you get nothing back.
In some cases, people get less than what they put in terms of premium.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's shocking out there. But to stay safe from that shocking, folks, that's exactly why we say reduce the agreement to writing, and wherever possible, deal with a regulated service provider. Now, of course, we understand that some of these community service providers, you might want to start as a Stockfell type with people that are together and all of that. Reduce everything to writing. From our side, we are not providing you with financial advice. This is not the show that does financial advice. And we'd hate for you to come back to us and say we've given you financial advice, or that someone else has given you financial advice and you'd like help from us to deal with that matter. Speak to financial services providers. That's why they have regulation. That's why they are regulated. That's why we advise that you deal with regulated entities. But that's the note that we're going to leave the deep dive on. We want to just get your thoughts and your experiences and your opinions on what you've gone through. What funeral services providers have you been using? How much have you been paying for these plans and policies that have been put in place? And have you gotten your money's worth? Have you had incidents where you wanted to put in a claim, you were unable to put in a claim because you thought you were covered and you weren't? We'd love to hear your experiences. Please share those with us and do some homework if you are looking at getting the coverage from your perspective for your loved ones. That's the deep dive. And we wrap things up with Investor Insights. We are taking a look at the delisting announcement from a company called AO Technologies. We're going to update our wall. We're going to add something very interesting to the wall. And then we're going to, of course, share with you our unfiltered opinion of the week. AO Technologies, firstly, this is particularly interesting for us because of the history of this particular stock. The business, for those that don't know, AO Technologies, one of the big shareholders there is Sekunjalo. Is it Sekunjalo Investments or Sekunjalo Holdings? Sekunjalo Investment Holdings, both of those. And they have decided to buy up the rest of AO Technology and delist that company. Now, the interesting part about this is AO, from a business perspective, is a company that in the past, the PIC has put in a significant amount of money. $4.5 billion
or something, I forget.
I think it was 4.3, but 4.5 is close enough of an estimate. More than 4 billion rand into, that's billion with a B, yes, into the company. And the company's performance has been less than impressive, to say the least, given that of that 4 billion rand, the PIC has entered into a settlement agreement of sorts, expecting to recover less than 800 million rand with an M, right? So we've lost the B, we're down to an M. So, I mean, even if you were to recover a billion rand of the 4 billion rand investment, you've lost 75% of your investment value. Now, this company is deciding to delist, and that brings a couple of questions. Companies have delisted in the past. No real surprises here. I mean, the likes of African Rainbow Capital, ARK, they've decided to delist as well. Mm-hmm. So the delistings are a common part of life. Barloworld is another example. Mm-hmm. They're entering into a transaction
Metrofile.
It happens. It happens very, very often. But I want to look at the return on investment from that perspective. So a lot of what drives delistings is things like a share price trading at a discount for a significant period of time and the company finally feeling, you know what, this discount is too deep of a discount and we're better off just taking the company off the listing requirements. For some, it's the listing requirements become too onerous, it's not worth our time, and we're delisting, right? So Sasfin's another one that this is just this year that we've kind of looked at delistings that are happening. This one in particular, very little return on investment for shareholders, a negative return if anything.
Well, listed at 43 Rand, trading at 40 cents.
Right. Listed at 43 Rand, trading at 40 cents. At this point, I suppose the delisting becomes academic because will you ever get back to the 43 Rand? When was the listing?
December 17.
December 17.
Am I right about that? I think it was December 17.
So call it 8 years?
Yeah.
7.5 to 8 years. Seven and a half to 8 years. And your share price has lost 99% of its value almost?
Yeah. And they had, but remember at the same time, off topic entirely, they were listing a second company, something, I forget, which never got to market. They were going to be the Google, Amazon, and Apple of Africa. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that never got to market. So you're not getting your money back. 43 Rand to 45, actually closed at 45 on Friday. There's no liquidity. The only person who's made money here is AO Technologies, who got the 4.3 billion. From the PIC. It's been a disaster. Ann Crotchy was writing their last set of results. I think their single biggest expense was lawyers' bills. They keep on getting sued. Remember they had bank accounts closed and stuff?
Yes,
actually had some businesses. I remember back when they listed, they had something they were doing with Sasol. There were some other bits and pieces. They've just, the whole PIC thing has just, and it's just soured it. If you're looking to outsource and AO Technologies arrives as one of the folks wanting to provide the service, you're kind of like, next, please. I mean, it's just your brand is tarnished.
And that's not a good place to be. I mean, I suppose from a business perspective, I guess that's also why you then look at delisting to say, you know what, things haven't gone as planned. And granted, the economy of the world has been different.
Sure.
We've seen things happen, you know, life happens, right? Right. Life has been different. But to not have had a meaningful return be provided to shareholders in 7 or 8 years and then suddenly come back to the shareholders and say, here's pennies on the dollar for what's left of your holdings, it's a bit tough.
Yeah, and they claim to have restricted cash of 61 million. I don't know what restricted cash is because that then shouldn't be a current asset. But and then lots of liabilities. They are technically solvent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it is just, I mean, it's. I mean, they say that the book value per share is $6.
How do I recover that value as a shareholder?
Oh, no, so, the book value of the share is now $1. I was looking at the wrong side.
Okay, so how do I recover value from an investment in that case? I mean, I'm the PIC or a retail investor.
It's really, really quite simple. Sell, put it somewhere else, and that one goes up. How is this? So to be clear, it's 99% down, but to get back to where you started, you need to go up 100-fold.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing becomes 100 bagger,
mm-hmm.
and it's now 43 rand.
And then you're just breaking even.
Now you are breaking even.
Technically, you're not breaking even because to hold some of these stocks, if you'd been depending on how you've been holding, there'd been financing costs, mm-hmm. all of those sorts of things, and additional mm-hmm. charges. So you might even mm-hmm. need to go beyond that price.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that restricted cash disappeared. I don't know where it went. It's no longer there. 100%. You're not in any good set. No, I mean, look, this happens. I might have told the story. I put 20,000 rand in to a stock. 15 years later, I got 51 rand back. It's not just that I lost 99.9, it's that I could have put that money in the bank and done better, and mm-hmm. actually turned my 20,000 into 30,000 over the period, or as the case may be. My bad. Cash and cash equivalents, 243 on a market cap of 146. Have they paid the PIC yet? Because I checked and the PIC is still listed as a 26% shareholder.
No.
So fun fact.
So the agreement of the PIC, I want to jump in here, and perhaps that might add to your fun fact. The agreement with the PIC is the repayment will take place at the point where assets exceed liabilities on the company, if I remember correctly. That was a clear distinction that they made as part of the settlement agreement. So for as long as liabilities on the business continue to exceed the assets of the business, they're not obligated to make that repayment.
Okay. And I was looking at the wrong quarters. So assets are 14667. Liabilities are liabilities and equity. Yeah, okay. No. So the problem is PSC earns 25.52.
Mm-hmm.
They can block it.
They can block the delisting. Okay, take me through that.
Well, if they vote no, they don't get the 75% threshold. This is a special resolution. It needs 75% of shareholders to approve it.
Oh.
Problem is they just can't pay the PIC the money that they've promised to pay, or that they've been told to pay.
Let's be clear around
that. It wasn't a promise. It was a court, or actually it was an out-of-court settlement.
So they agreed to...
They did agree to
that pay. Amount. Okay, so I'm
so
sitting
the PIC
there.
Could block it, but I mean, what do they get from blocking it? I mean, like, they're not getting money here, so...
And even if it goes through and they finally recover the balance of it...
PSC lost 4.3 billion. Fortunately, in the PSC's life, that's not even a rounding error.
Fortunately, it's not even a rounding error. Okay, we're going to leave that one on that note, because that's as much as we can contribute towards that matter. It's going to happen with or without us and with or without our opinions. But what we can share an opinion, and that is what it is, an opinion on, is something that we're going to add to our wall. This one... was something that I didn't realize that we'd overlooked for this long, right? So we discussed Palantir at some point, saying it's a US defense stock, great, lovely, all of those sorts of things. And now with Elon Musk having left Doggy, whatever it is you're calling it, and the...
We called that because his 130 days is up.
Yes.
Way back in February.
Yes. 130 days, finally up. Mm-hmm. He's gone. That's mm-hmm. done and dusted.
Mm-hmm.
But the United States has been kind of, I want to say, closing down certain things and redirecting that money into mm-hmm. other areas. And we know the United States quite well by now. They redirect into one thing, that is military spend. Mm-hmm. That is the Pentagon. The Pentagon has the single largest budget of anyone in the world. In fact, the last time I checked, the Pentagon's budget, or the military spend that went into the United States, was more than, if we take the top 10 military spends in the world, the United States sits first. The other 9 players combined don't get to the more than $1 trillion that the Pentagon
and
spends.
And eight of those nine
are allies. Right. So that gives you a bit of context around how much the United States spends on military. And we thought, how did we miss this entire time? One of the biggest companies that has been the most profitable from the US military in terms of contracts and things, and has provided probably the most consistent return on investment, is a company called Lockheed Martin.
Yeah. I don't know how. So
how
they
did we
are,
miss this?
They are in aeronautics, mm-hmm. missile and fire control,
mm-hmm.
rotary and mission systems,
mm-hmm.
and space.
And space.
Space.
So From an aeronautics perspective, there was a rumor at some point that Lockheed Martin wanted to make a plane that a plane that deploys planes. So for those folks out there that have watched
a plane craft carrier.
Yes, like an aircraft carrier, but
except a proper aircraft carrier,
exactly,
but carrying
that carries
aircraft.
Yes. And so those that have watched any of the Marvel movies or any of the Star Wars movies, you know what the large aircraft carriers look like. I forgot what they're called now.
Aircraft carriers.
No, the destroyers. The destroyer in Star Trek, Star Wars. That destroyer, Lockheed Martin wants to build one of those. Who are they fighting a war with?
You mean like the Death Star?
Like that? Who are they fighting a war with?
So, rhetorical question, but what America has a lot of soft power. One of their soft powers is that if you mess with us, we are going to smear you over everywhere. Now, that hasn't quite perhaps worked as well, but it does kind of, and countries benefited from it. Europe and NATO, Canada, this is all of Trump's complaints. These countries undoubtedly benefited from this soft power, also America. And that's part of the thing. But they have so much, they've got more bases around the world, soldiers on non-US bases than the EU has soldiers on EU bases.
But this is what I'm saying. America's making it seem as though they haven't benefited from deploying their troops everywhere throughout the world.
Soft power drive. So there was a meme on Twitter this weekend that's a lie that was saying Xi Jinping's daughter goes to Harvard. Xi Jinping would not let his daughter go to Harvard. But there are many leaders of many countries whose daughters or sons do go to Harvard. And it's that sort of soft power. But I mean, back to the point. I mean, they have far too much spending, although the interest bill has just overtaken the defense bill in their budget. But the short version is defense is always going to be huge. And with NATO wanting to, one of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago Accord points is that the NATO countries must up their spend, truthfully, only to what their commitment is, which I think is 2% of GDP. Most have been underspending. Germany's now actually prepared to push that to 4 or 5. These sort of companies like Lockheed suddenly
let's leave the Germans alone. We know what the Germans do in a war. Let's leave them alone for now.
There's conflicting thoughts.
Oh, that's another story for another day, perhaps for another show. So Lockheed Martin, where are we putting it on the wall? I mean, it's a stock that, you know, it's one of those stocks where, you know, when you look at a company and we look at a company's balance sheet and we look at a company that produces things, that has inventory, that has suppliers and all of that, you always want to look at the strength of that company's order book, particularly if you're constructing. If you're a Boeing, if you're a PPC, the strength of your order book determines how much longevity you have. If you're a Murray and Roberts, a WBHO, all of those things. Lockheed Martin falls into that category quite distinctly. And I think they have an unfair advantage in that the strength of their order book is the entire United States military.
Yeah.
So for me, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah. No, I mean, agreed on that. I mean, to your point, I mean, we somehow just totally missed this. Their non-interest margin fluctuates a bit, but I mean, it kind of sits there at around about the 7 or 8%. It gets a little higher at times, a little lower at times. This is a nice looking business. Chart goes bottom left, top right. I mean, it's not as volatile. Mm-hmm. I was expecting a more volatile chart.
Why?
Because you lose orders, wars end, wars start.
Yeah, but if your client is consistently having wars, then you've got a consistent bottom left, top right effect.
Yeah.
Consistency from your client is important here.
And it's well off the $600 highs, which was actually, weirdly, October 2024.
That's where are we sitting at the moment?
482.
482. Okay. Mm. Do we like it enough for it to be blue chip is the real question.
I think it can be.
You think it can be?
Yeah, I mean, I really do. Dividend yield a little smizy at 2.7, but Americans don't much like dividends. They've been buying back shares. They've gone from 320 to 234 million shares in the last decade. So buying back shares as opposed to dividend. Forward PE, 17.5. Not giant, but to your point is that They have a perpetual client. $20 billion of debt, $2 billion of cash.
Yeah. And they're not bothered by the $20 billion of debt because they've got a consistent client. Question then becomes is, in the event that we live in a world where America is no longer waging war on other people, what happens to Lockheed Martin?
So the question, two things. They start selling to other nations. Can America reduce their defense spending even in a world where they aren't doing as many wars? The answer is yes.
But where the president also, sorry, so I want to jump in. open here, because the president also then says he doesn't want wars. Yeah. He doesn't believe the Russia-Ukraine war should have happened.
And then he started a war with the Houthis. I know. He thought the Houthis were like, dum-dum, they'll be all gone.
Yeah.
Apparently they spent a lot of money and nothing happened. I hear you, but I don't see it. I mean, I do see Donald Trump and the Republican Party, and frankly, surely the Democratic Party as well, wanting to pull back on defense spending. You just got to be so very, very careful. A lot of that is going to revolve around having to close bases and the like, and I do think that'll start to happen. It's going to be a slow process, but I don't think that the demand for ammunitions and bombs and other such things is going anywhere but up.
Okay. Fair enough. So there's always going to be a demand there. Interestingly enough, perhaps the other side of it is, while we're thinking about the aircraft carrier, it's the heli carrier from Marvel, but more sophisticated because it doesn't just launch planes. It can hold them, it can fly them, all sorts of things, right? Do you think, and this is probably the parting thought on Lockheed Martin, that if there is a dry up, if there is a kind of slow down in business, Lockheed Martin could go back to the Pentagon and say, hey guys, we'll build you an Iron Dome.
Yeah, an Iron Dome or a fancy invisible jet. There's always something.
It's always something, right? Cool. There we go. There's always something out there.
Golden Dome.
Golden Dome. All right. There we go. That's what we're going to call it. Cool. There's always something out there for companies like Lockheed Martin to focus on when wars aren't happening. Very, very strange. But we're going to leave that on that note. And we're going to wrap up the show on that note. Before we go, of course, we have an unfiltered opinion of the week for you. Very much along the lines of the one that we gave you last week. This week's unfiltered opinion is that the companies out there, the bakeries out there, those that are able to, so the likes of the Blue Ribbons and the Albanese, bring back the half loaf. It was convenient. You didn't have the wastage of a full loaf in some cases. For families, great, lovely. It's always lovely to have the full loaf. You make sandwiches for lunch and the kids have lunch and all of that. But if you're someone that doesn't have a big family, if you're living alone, if you're you and the missus, just the two of you at home, you don't need the full loaf of bread over a 2-day period. If you happen to be traveling, right? Bring back the half loaf. It's convenient for everyone.
Make more bread and butter pudding.
Or make more bread and butter pudding.
You haven't heard of bread and butter pudding.
That's okay. Cool. We're going to leave it on that note. Remember, folks, investing isn't hard. Just try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.